You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 9th of October 2017 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily in association with UBS. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to the Monocle Daily here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Coming up in the programme, why did President Donald Trump send Vice President Mike Pence to Indianapolis to walk out of a Colts game? Surely if Trump wanted to punish Pence, he'd have made him watch the whole thing. Also ahead,
the US has reached a stage where it's saying that Turkey is basically taking hostages in an attempt to force the United States to hand over Fethullah Gulen to extradite him to Turkey so that he could face trial here.
We'll have the latest from Turkey as a diplomatic row escalates between Ankara and Washington. Later in the show, we'll talk to Sir Lawrence Friedman about his new book, The Future of War.
If you could get in a surprise first strike that effectively disarmed your opponent, then they would be completely at your mercy and the idea is that they would give in. But if you know that if you hit them, however wounded they are, however hurt they are, they'll hit you back, then you're going to be a bit more cautious.
And we will reflect upon the unmasking of Harvey Weinstein. All that and more coming up in the next 60 minutes on the Monocle Daily, live from London on Monocle 24. It is a little over a year since the release of a tape of a conversation in which Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump cheerfully boasted of committing sexual assault. At the time, it was widely assumed that this was the end of his improbable tilt at the White House. A year later, it barely seems remarkable when, in the space of a weekend, he sends his vice president on a mission to walk theatrically out of a football game, claims that he's the real victim of a natural disaster which has left millions of Americans without electricity or drinking water, and gets accused of being an intemperate simpleton by the Republican chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Well, journalist and broadcaster and regular Monocle 24 contributor Michael Goldfarb joins me in the studio to discuss these freshest hells. The Mike Pence thing first. There are those that would argue that in not having to sit through a Colts game, he got off rather lightly. But who was supposed to be impressed by that?
It's too complicated. I mean, it's they do really know how to tweak the media. There's this feral quality.
It is the thing they're good at.
You know, and the thing is that I'm not sure that they have brainstorming sessions like they have in advertising agencies about we've got a new product to launch and, you know, the 55 different suggestions as to how to launch it. I think it's quite feral. It's like instantaneous. Pence is really a weird guy in all this because before he hooked up with Donald Trump, you know, he was the governor of Indiana. He'd been a congressman before that, a right-wing talk radio personality. And he seems to be completely under his thumb. When he was first brought in as a potential vice president, the idea wasn't Bob Corker, who we will get to, senator from Tennessee,
indeed,
had been mentioned in the frame to perhaps be a vice presidential candidate. He seemed to be independent. He seemed to be the voice of the Republican Party to this outsider. Never forget that Trump really has never been a Republican. He's given money to all candidates, and he has no ideology except himself. So here's Mike Pence, and the Indianapolis Colts are honoring Peyton Manning, their one and only truly great superstar in the entire existence of the team, led them to a couple of Super Bowls. And he goes out to honor Peyton Manning, whose number is being retired, big statue being unveiled outside the stadium in Indianapolis. They're playing the San Francisco 49ers, which is where this taking a knee.
This was Colin Kaepernick's team, of course.
Right, and his friend who still plays for them, Eric Reed, who's an extraordinarily articulate guy, has kind of converted the team, and they all still protest, you know, the treatment of African Americans and inequality in America. So you knew they were going to take a knee. They planned it all. Pence arrives. Before he arrives, he tells the traveling press who travel with the vice president, which is possibly the worst job in journalism, you may not be here for long. And the San Francisco 49ers take a knee, and very ostentatiously, Mike Pence stands up and leaves. And if he had just done that, if he had not told the traveling press, you may not be here long, if And then if Donald Trump hadn't tweeted, Pence did what told him, you know, we wouldn't be talking about it.
Pence did issue a statement of his own, which, I mean, I did assume that Pence wasn't a complete idiot, but it is a remarkable statement. He said, "I left today's Colts game because President Trump and I will not dignify any event that disrespects our soldiers, our flag, or our national anthem." So we can assume then that Pence does not count as such the making fun of fighter pilot prisoners of war, the bullying of Gold Star families, and, you know, I mean, it writes itself, this stuff. We do need to move on to what Bob Corker said, and to remind our listeners, he is a senator from Tennessee. He is a Republican. He is the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He's very, very far from being a left-wing firebrand. He is not seeking further office and is therefore able to speak his mind. But he did basically say, in so many words, that the President of the United States is a complete idiot who is utterly incapable of doing his job.
He also went on to say that everybody's worried because he's perfectly capable of starting World War III.
The obvious question then being, at what point do Corker, who has been foursquare behind Trump before now, it has to be said, at what, this is the thing that baffles me, these are all serious people, Republican congressional contingent, they are people who, like all politicians, have an eye to posterity and their place in history. At what point does one of them decide, I'm going to be the guy that stops this nonsense?
It's not going to happen. This is what, here's what I learned on my summer holiday in America. 2 weeks where I wasn't actually there for work, although I did take my recording equipment, because every day with Trump, if you're in America and you're not prepared to commit journalism, you're a fool, because something might happen. Anyway, what I learned was that the core, the 35-38% of Americans who support him, are not ready to give up that support. They are a perfect match to the Republican vote. Bob Corker's retiring, and Trump was wasn't teasing. He was tweeting back and saying, "You're only saying this because, you know, I didn't endorse you or tell you to stay on as senator from Tennessee."
But when you talk about that 35-38% base, and I know you've spent a lot of time there and interviewed these people and so on and so on, Trump's petty, undignified bitching on social media, that they don't think that that's beneath the office.
Well, you know, it's really interesting, Andrew, because, you know, in your introduction, you were talking about, is a year ago today.
A year ago Friday, I think.
The New York Times headline, they did some reporting over the weekend. A year ago today, the headline was, Trump's latest, this was about the infamous pussy grabbing tape, is the last straw for the GOP. That very day I was in America, I got in a rental car, I went out to Western Pennsylvania, which was tilting towards Trump, and I went to the local Republican Party headquarters in Johnstown, and I sat with a couple of elderly volunteers. They were all elderly, including a very good Catholic lady who was all Republican because of the abortion issue. I said, what do you think when you see this? That's just locker room talk. I said, doesn't it offend you? I mean, you're obviously, she was a nurse. I said, a retired nurse, she was in her 70s. I said, doesn't this offend you? I mean, as a woman, as a practicing Roman Catholic, and clearly someone who's sincere about your moral beliefs, that you would back this. He supports life, and that's all that matters. Everything else, you know, it's fake news coming from, you know, the left-wing media, and on and on and on. And it's amazing to see one's own native land with 40% of the population self-brainwashed. And that's where it is.
I want to close quickly on a hypothetical. If, as you say, for those reasons, the House Republicans and the Senate Republicans are not about to give up on Trump, would it make any imaginable difference if one of the designated grown-ups around him, one of the three generals, you know, Kelly, Mattis, or McMaster, just walked out in front of the press and went, look, I've tried, but it's hopeless?
To a certain degree, it would. You know, I mean, what Corker said was everybody knows it, and it seems like everybody does. And I do think that the generals and Rex Tillerson, Secretary of State, carry a lot of sway, at least behind closed doors. And if they were to come out in a unified front and say, that's it, we're off, good luck, you guys handle it, it might change things. But they won't. That's the point. Because they see it as duty. Maybe not Rex Tillerson, he's not military, but the other three do see it as duty. And it's just not going to happen.
Well, on that encouraging note, Michael Goldfarb, thank you as always for joining us. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. This is the Monocle Daily live from Studio One at Midori House in London. The United States has now suspended most visa services vis-a-vis Turkey, and Turkey has responded in kind. The diplomatic standoff follows last week's arrest of a Turkish citizen working at the US consulate in Istanbul and the attempt by Turkish authorities to question at least one more. A bit earlier, we spoke with the journalist Laura Patel in Ankara, who told us what we know about the second consulate worker.
Prosecutors have asked him to come in for questioning, but he hasn't gone. It's rumoured and reported in the Turkish press that he has been sheltering in the US consulate for his own safety, in Istanbul that is, but that his wife and child weren't in the consulate and they instead have been detained instead of him.
Okay, and this row started with the detention of another US consulate worker last week. What do we know for sure about that one?
So that person was a long-serving official with the US Embassy, a Turkish national working for the US government in Turkey. And he was accused by the Turks of liaising with a prosecutor close to Fethullah Gülen. This is the exiled cleric living in the United States who is accused of masterminding the Turkish coup attempt that have turned this country upside down last year. He was arrested, as you said, last week. He was actually the second US Turkish national working for the US to have been arrested. So there's actually three of them who are now either arrested or wanted, as well as around 10 other US citizens arrested in this country. So that's the official reason why this spat has really escalated over this last 24 hours. But there are other kind of underlying reasons. I think this was the kind of latest manifestation. It was like the straw that broke the camel's back from the US government's point of view.
So is this Erdogan and the Turkish government getting at the United States because the United States refuses to hand over Fethullah Gülen, or is there something else going on?
Well, yeah, it is, I think. I mean, Erdogan has quite almost really explicitly said that that's what's happening. You know, not long ago, he made some comments saying, you know, you want us to release a preacher. He's referring to this US preacher who's been in Turkish custody for almost a year. He says, you want us to release him. Well, you also have a preacher. You've got Fethullah Gülen. And so the US has reached the stage where it's saying that Turkey is basically taking hostages in an attempt to force the United States to hand over Fethullah Gülen, to extradite him to Turkey so that he could face trial here.
So if Erdogan picks a big fight with the United States, does he have Turkish public opinion on side?
Well, it's a really interesting question. I think that, like, largely he probably does. I mean, Turkish society is very, very divided, roughly in half, between those who like Erdogan and those who dislike him. And so those who really don't like him, I guess, might have some sympathy for the US or might be pleased to see somebody finally standing up to the man that they don't like. But at the same time, Turkey is a country that has very deep-seated and long-standing anti-Americanism across the board throughout the political spectrum. And so actually, I also think that quite a lot of Turkish citizens of all political stripes might also find this action by the US a bit distasteful, especially seeing as suspending visa services is something that affects normal people, you know, who might be going on holiday or to visit friends or family or on business.
How much pressure does it put Erdogan under, by which I guess I'm asking, how long can he sustain this if the currency market and the stock market continue to respond in the way they have? It's not been a good day for the Turkish lira or for Turkish stocks.
Right. And in that regard, the US has really hit him where it hurts. The lira and the stock market have taken a real hammering over the last 24 hours. And the economy is Erdogan's vulnerability. He has built his success. He's been in power for 15 years and he's built his success on the back of rising prosperity and impressive economic growth. And the Turkish economy took a hit, a bad hit last year after the coup attempt, but it's recovered quite well thanks to a lot of like government stimulus. We've seen figures in the first two quarters of this year of around 5% growth. But economists and analysts have always said that Turkey is very vulnerable to external shocks. And that includes the lira taking a massive hammering. And the US has a lot more clout. This is not a balanced fight, the Turkish economy versus the US economy. And Erdogan is going to be feeling the pain. You know, you've already had business groups today calling for this to be resolved quickly. Turkey has much bigger arguments going on, or longer running arguments going on, with the European Union, which is its biggest trading partner. And Erdogan can't really afford for there to be a sustained attack on the Turkish lira.
That was Laura Patel in Ankara. Joining us live now from Istanbul is the journalist Andrew Finkel. Andrew, as diplomatic spats go, how serious is this one?
Well, I think it's a very serious spat. I don't think anyone can remember an instance where a foreign power has actually closed its visa services to Turkish citizens. This is a NATO ally. This is a country which, you know, is a strategic asset to the United States, and yet they've gone so far as really to not put it in the same category quite as North Korea or Chad, but certainly question the legitimacy of the regime.
As far as it's possible to tell, what does Erdogan actually want? Where is he going with this?
Well, it's not entirely clear. He certainly has his objectives. He sees his differences with the United States. He, as your previous interviewee said, he's very keen to get this Fethullah Gulen, the person they blame for the last year's coup, to be repatriated to Turkey. He has other objectives with the United States. He's very angry at the way that the U.S. has supported Syrian Kurds as their chief way of fighting the Islamic State. Turkey regards them as a sort of fifth column, as people related to the PKK, the terrorists who Kurdish separatists who operate against Turkey itself. So there's that. That's a very sore point. And there's another thing that is making Turkey very anxious. The United States has arrested a Iranian Turkish businessman and the vice president of a Turkish state bank in the United States, and they're being held on for sanctions busting against Iran. And I think Mr. Erdogan and his friends are worried that that case will prove highly embarrassing to them personally, that there'll be huge allegations of corruption that will come out during that trial.
How much economic disruption might Erdogan have priced in, though? At what point does the economy start to outrun his personal concerns?
Well, of course, he has a busy political agenda ahead of him. He's about to sort of run for an executive presidency, he already enjoys enormous powers, but there'll be an election which will make those powers official. So he really is. You know, has his hands full. And he, again, as your previous speaker said, there's been an artificial stimulus to the economy. The Turkish economy appears to be doing very well ahead of those elections. So anything that would sort of deflate that bubble ahead of the elections is something of great concern to him. I think the example we have to look at is the spat in 2015, the Turkey shot down a Russian jet which had strayed into its airspace, and Russia imposed very serious economic sanctions against Turkey. They banned Turkish imports and took actions against Turkish contractors active in Russia. And at the end of the day, Turkey backed down.
Andrew Finkel in Istanbul, thanks for joining us. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
You're listening to The Monocle Daily with me, Andrew Muller. A time-worn military wisdom cautions that no plan survives contact with the enemy. Nevertheless, militaries make plans. It would be kind of irresponsible of them not to. As a consequence, an industry and a culture of pontificating and soothsaying about the future of warfare has developed, and yet it remains barely heard of for any conflict to proceed entirely as anticipated. A new book reflects on what we might learn in the present from what people have gotten wrong in the past. The book is The Future of War, A History by Sir Lawrence Freedman, Emeritus Professor of War Studies at King's College London. Sir Lawrence spoke to me earlier today here at Midori House.
When you think about it, say after the First World War, during that war, things started to introduce, say like the tank or the aircraft or gas that hadn't been available before. So a lot of the interwar period was about thinking how different it would be to the previous war. Similarly, the Second World War ended with nuclear weapons. So thoughts on future war after the Second World War were about a completely different experience where you'd see whole societies being obliterated. So it's not wholly true. What one can say is that the military can be quite conservative and that they have traditionally focused, from when I start the book in the mid-19th century to now, on battle. So what they want to do is to fight another battle against a regular force without lots of civilians getting involved or in the way or being targets and that being decisive. And they keep on sort of looking for that, and it rarely quite happens in the way they want.
Is that now, do you think, entirely a thing of the past, that, I guess, very Victorian idea of warfare, that you have one group of men in a particular uniform and another group of men in another uniform, and they meet on literally some battlefield somewhere and wage conflict like that? Is that ever going to happen again?
Well, it does happen on occasion. So, I mean, there are battles. Britain fought battles in the Falklands. There were the battles of the Iran-Iraq War. There were battles at the start, 2003, and then 2001 before that in Afghanistan. So there are battles, but they're not decisive. It's the ideal type to which a lot of military thinking tends. So that's why even now a lot of writing about future war focuses on two professional armed forces fighting each other rather than the sort of conflicts with which we've become all too familiar over the last couple of decades.
You think they still have some kind of attraction to the idea of the great climactic conflict?
Yes. The tradition from which this comes, which goes really back to the Napoleonic Wars, is quite a strong one and hard to shake off, which is that these big disputes are eventually going to be decided by force of arms. Who wins the battle will win the war. And once the war is won, then the political matters that divided these countries will be decided in the victor's favour. That's the model of warfare with which they're working. The difficulty is that first it's quite hard to win the battles decisively because some of the enemy force survives and they regroup and come back, or allies come in. Then they turn into sort of long campaigns of attrition in which economic and industrial factors become important, or the population resists. And so you're in a quite different sort of conflict to the one you started.
When you sort of reflect on the history of people attempting to predict what the next war will be like, are there repeated things that they get wrong? If not, I guess, in terms of specifics, in terms of themes, is there a consistent mode of poor thinking that people lapse into?
I think the most powerful idea is the idea of a knockout blow. If you believe that battle can be decisive, if you're going to take the initiative, it makes sense to do it by surprise. And if you really do it well by surprise, then the enemy is knocked out before they have any chance of recovering. So that really is the ideal. And the worst thing is to imagine this happening to you. So a lot of the literature is about how we're going to be caught in a surprise attack if we don't do the right things or make the right precautions. And then, of course, you do have there are great surprise attacks in history, like Pearl Harbor, for example, mm-hmm. which still weighs very heavily on the American imagination. So even when people are talking about cyber warfare, for example, it's sort of an electronic Pearl Harbor that they fear, with everything going blank and dark on the same day, rather than the sort of continual cat and mouse offense defense campaigns that go on in cyberspace, which is very different from some sort of all-out military attack.
In terms of the kind of decisive strike you're talking about, some militaries in the world, of course, at least since 1945, have had access to the absolute no comeback, mother of all decisive strikes, if you will. Are you surprised that since August 1945 it hasn't been used?
I'm relieved. The argument has been that you don't use it because the same will be done to you in return. So it's the ultimate question.
This is the mutual assured destruction.
It's mutual assured destruction. So if you could get in a surprise first strike that effectively disarmed your opponent, then they would be completely at your mercy, and the idea is that they would give in. But if you know that if you hit them, however wounded they are, however hurt they are, they'll hit you back, then you're going to be a bit more cautious. And so it has proved. And even with North Korea and the United States at the moment, you have to hope, and I believe it is the case, at least for now, that deterrence works, that people can see the risks they're running sufficiently for the critical moments for them to be cautious. The danger is if they start to miscalculate those risks or assume they can just go a little bit further than actually they can.
Information has, of course, always been a weapon of war, but it's now more possible to disseminate that information more swiftly and more widely than it ever has been before. What kind of difference might that end up making to the way wars are fought?
I think there's a belief at the moment that it makes a lot of difference. You find talk of hybrid warfare, which involves the normal things that armies do, combined with attempts to demoralise opponents or disorientate them through misinformation, or possibly accurate information that they'd rather not know about. I think this can be a bit exaggerated. The Russians clearly believe in it a lot, and even outside the military sphere have been waging their own forms of information warfare. And they can obviously have effect, but equally, as I think maybe they're thinking at the moment with Trump, they can also backfire. So it is an important aspect of fighting. But if you look, again, say at the Second World War, disinformation, often very carefully constructed, was an important part of military planning. Efforts to persuade the Germans that the Allies were going to land somewhere else than Normandy were a critical part of the preparations for D-Day. So, again, one can overstate what's new, but I think because of new technologies and the ability to acquire and disseminate information very easily, it is clearly something that's more important than it was before.
Do you consider yourself basically an optimist about the future of warfare? By which I mean, obviously, does it seem to you likely that wars will be fought less often and with fewer casualties? This is, of course, you'll be familiar with this, the Steven Pinker argument, that the world is actually becoming much more safe, much less cruel, but it may just be that what cruelties there are, we know much more about than we would have 50 or 60 years ago.
Yes, I deal with Pinker's argument in the book, and I don't find it totally convincing, to be honest. I mean, there's a number of methodological problems, one of which is people live longer, survive wounds better. A lot of people in wars died in the past because of poor healthcare. Disease was as much likely to take out your army as the enemy. So I think that there are methodological issues. And like all of these sort of great themes, almost as soon as it's published, there's an uptick in wars. So it didn't take account of Syria or Libya or Ukraine. So one has to be very careful with these arguments. So I'm not an optimist or a pessimist. I think there are reasons to suppose that wars will continue. The difficulty with wars, especially in places like sub-Saharan Africa and maybe the Middle East, is that once started, they're very difficult to stop.
Well, that is a constant throughout human history, I guess. But looking away from what you might call those low-level guerrilla wars, and I suspect you're right that they will continue much as they always have, but when you think about what the great powers will be able to bring to bear, and as more and more of it gets, I guess, outsourced to technology, in the same way that we see now with drones, that may become spread to remote control ground-based units. Is it possible that we end up in a sort of arena of meta war where everybody's sort of, remote drone proxies are shooting each other down with minimal damage to humanity?
Yes. Well, I mean, that's always been a sort of science fiction sort of image, and robotics is moving more in that direction. The problem with robots is having them, they don't run out of power after a few steps. So the American military at the moment certainly is thinking much more in terms, not so much of robots fighting wars all of themselves, but teaming between sort of the humans and the robots much more. And robots, not just drones, but bomb disposal and so on, will be more important. I think the point is that what are you fighting about? You're largely fighting about territory. Who owns it? And if you're fighting about territory, then somehow you've got to occupy it and pacify it. And if you're doing that, you're dealing with disgruntled human beings who you want to make happier human beings, or you want to cow them into submission. And it's not clear how well robots can do that sort of thing. And you can interfere with robots. So it's an increasing part of war, no doubt. But the human element in war will always be there.
Just finally then, if we think of the future of warfare over the next 10, 20, 30 years, what kind of things should military planners be considering? This is with all due respect to the fact that, you know, events, dear boy, events, as a wise leader once said, but what should they be worrying about?
Well, for the first thing to keep in mind is the best predictor of future wars is past wars. Wars tend to take place where they've taken place before, and the parts of the world that have concerned us should still concern us. And that's point one. Point two, one of the key factors, in addition, one might argue, to nuclear weapons in preventing great power war has been the American system of alliances. It has produced a degree of order in both Europe and Asia. And it's not altogether clear that that can continue, not just because of this president, but I think just over the long term. There's something artificial to it. And if that happens, then there's a greater risk of a free-for-all in places where we've assumed political relations are quite stable. I would see this as a bigger risk in Asia than in Europe, but it's always a risk. So I think it's the politics that you've got to keep the closest eye on. In terms of technology, I think you tend to fight with legacy systems, the sort of stuff that we have coming through now, that our armies have got at the moment, our navies have got at the moment, is what's going to be most relevant for the next 10 or 20 years. Over the longer term, that may start to look a lot different. But I think there's a danger in exaggerating the transformation that can come with technology. The biggest changes tend to be political.
That was Sir Lawrence Freedman speaking to me earlier. Sir Lawrence's new book, The Future of War, is published by Penguin. You're listening to The Daily. Now, it has become a wearisomely familiar dynamic. It is revealed that a terrible man has been doing terrible things for a terribly long time, at which point a chorus of his former associates and colleagues confirmed that they'd either known or heard about his terribleness, but nevertheless nobody had called him on it. The latest to find himself the richly deserving, if weirdly overdue, occupant of this pillory is the Hollywood mogul Harvey Weinstein, outed by the New York Times as a prolific and perennial sex pest. Though Weinstein has apologised for his behaviour, he is also threatening legal action against the Times. I'm joined now by the film critic, Karen Krasanovich. Karen, in the last few days, we have seen quite a few actors, some of whom were clients, associates, colleagues of Weinstein, speaking up in condemnation. How surprised do you think any of them are?
Surprised about this, the revelation, or the fact that it's been in the New York Times?
Surprised by the revelation in the New York Times. Has this been one of those things that everybody knew but nobody ever really spoke about?
Well, it's sort of like Bill Cosby in a way. It's one of these things that you sort of heard about, but in a way you sort of expected from people in power, not just men, but probably we hear more about men. And I think it's because it's sort of like, you know, why do guys join bands? To get girls, right? Yay! I'm not saying that that's why powerful people can become powerful. But there was always discussion, I mean, back in Cannes in the 90s, we always heard that one of the Weinsteins was, you know, a bit like that, a bit of a lecher. And we were just kind of like, oh, you know, well, hmm. And I've heard stories of people that were in rooms with him, and men and women, where he was, you know, very aggressive, assertive, throwing things, being, you know, pushing people, not literally pushing people around, but being very aggressive.
Is it possible, and this is a question being asked with an inflection of hope, is it possible that this kind of behaviour is becoming harder to get away with? Because it's easier for people who have a story to tell to now tell that story.
Well, that's a really good question. It's very easy to accuse people, and it's very difficult to defend yourself, because it's always like, no, you know, there's, why is there smoke if there's no fire? But what I find interesting is why it's come out now, when these women have talked about this sort of stuff and people, you know, knew about it. And it's because when someone is in power, we want to be part of that power. And most of us will do whatever we can. And these sort of creative industries particularly, who knows, maybe the sewage industry is just as bad. but it's one of these things like, you've got a choice. You can either get this fantastic break by putting up with this crap, or you can say no and end up working as a barista.
Because it is the case, isn't it? Not just with the American figures we've been talking about, but also with the revelations of about the personal behaviour of a great many light entertainment sure. figures here in Britain, that sure. none of these stories broke when these people were at the height of their exactly. fame and power. It's always when they're, if not necessarily on the way out, but they're dwindling. They're not the figure they once were.
That's exactly right. And I believe that from what I had heard, there was something leaked to the Times, New York Times, possibly from his own company, and I haven't confirmed that. That's allegation, that's reportage, that they were trying to actually get him out of the own company. And I just read that they are going to change the name of the company and take his name off films. Now, you remember how funny we used to think Bill Cosby was fantastic? I don't know if anybody ever thought Berlusconi was great. But, you know, I mean, you've got to think about these things. Why is this being reported now? I'm not condoning this kind of behavior. But what I'm saying is that I think it's been going on for a long time. And the reason that we put up with it is because we are afraid that our lives, that the opportunities that these people, you know, possibly could offer us could be ruined or taken away.
He will come back from this, won't he? You can already see the narrative being laid down. He's going to make a great big show of undertaking therapy and counselling. He'll write some ghastly emetic memoir, sort of taking responsibility for his actions, but almost certainly blaming it on some other trauma that wasn't really his fault, and a few years from now to be more or less forgotten about.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if Mel Gibson has really recovered from everything, but I don't think he can go back to the Miramax level. I don't think, because apparently he hasn't been talking to his brother for about a year. So I don't think that he can actually come back from this. Not the Weinstein of old, no.
Are we buying the excuse that he's already offered? His quote was, "I came of age in the 60s and 70s when all the rules about behaviour and workplaces were different. That was the culture then. I've since learned it's not an excuse in the office or out of it." But the thing is that there were people in the 60s and 70s who didn't behave like that. It's still a choice, isn't it?
That is true. That is true. And I think doing something unpleasant to someone when they just want a job has probably always been the same, 40s, 50s, maybe even 20s and 30s. Who, maybe even the 19th century, you know, we could just go back where, you know, people in power predate on people who want something, who need something.
But
from
you kind of wonder at what point, whatever the age, the person in power doesn't ask themselves, am I being a jerk? This is starting to seem like the sort of thing a total jerk would do.
I think, well, exactly. But I also think that people in power have a different mindset, and they say to themselves, this is one of the perks of the job.
Doubtless. But as for the rest of us, are we too forgiving of the great entertainers? I don't know quite what to think about this, because I am uncomfortably aware that quite a lot of my very favourite records,
sure.
for example, have been made by thoroughly, thoroughly dreadful people.
Well, David Bowie actually had sexual allegations against him, you know, so it's like, ugh. I think you have to separate the person from their art. I don't think you have to like the artist, but you can like the art.
There has also been an inevitable, it's become politicized, the Weinstein thing, as everything in America now is. Donald Trump Jr., rather wonderfully, has decided to engage in this argument, suggesting that it reflects badly on Hillary Clinton, she associated with Harvey Weinstein. And I mean, Donald Trump Jr. attempting to sort of take the moral high ground vis-a-vis sexual harassment claims, I don't really know where to start.
He's just trying to help.
I mean, it's... it is what it is. But should Democrats now make a point of returning the donations that he made to them, or should they give them to charity? Or if you do that, are you just then fighting Donald Trump Jr.'s battles for him?
I think you just have to show that that money went to a good cause, you know? I think, like, starving children or something, you know? I think if you can track that money, you don't have to give it back. That's my rule. But I really think, and I actually tweeted this just a few minutes ago, that who is in power now? Who are the heavy hitters in Hollywood about which this is being whispered and about which we're saying nothing because they're still players? That's my question.
Karen Krasanovich, thanks as always for joining us. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world.
Time now on The Daily to take a look at the Asian newspapers. We're joined once again by Agatha Kratz, Associate Policy Fellow for the Asia and China Program at the European Council on Foreign Relations. First of all, to Myanmar, and this is, well, there's now some suggestion, this is a report from Channel News Asia, that after some several weeks now of watching Rakhine State burning and the Rohingya people fleeing, that something of a sort is going to be done. Possibly?
Yeah, I mean, it's very far off and it won't come within the next few days. But the EU and the US are now considering targeted sanctions against military leaders, not the whole regime, but military leaders in Myanmar. And that's, as you said, that's been long due to a certain extent. They're just discussing it, though, for the moment, and it would target the highest ranking military officials in the country. It would be freezes on assets. It would be forbidding them to travel. It would be forbidding people, either from the US or from the EU, to do business with them. But of course, if you have a country that doesn't have much EU or US investment, as Myanmar has for the moment, or if you don't have much military leverage, it's not going to do as much.
But is this the world trying to find a way to keep Aung San Suu Kyi off the hook as well, so she's still in place as the sort of friendly face of a new open Myanmar, the person we can actually talk to?
I mean, the one thing that there's a very, very big kind of agreement about among players here, so the US, the EU, Japan, and another a few other Western powers, is that it's only going to target military leaders, so it wouldn't target, as you say, Aung San Suu Kyi, which would kind of, yeah, exactly. So give Aung San Suu Kyi a second chance of a sort, or at least say, well, it was the military who was involved and they were the ones in responsible for what happened, and just give democracy and or Aung San Suu Kyi's regime a second chance.
Moving along to the Straits Times, and this is, well, it's actually quite a good story with a very, very weird and strangely inappropriate headline, which
absolutely.
Is, Meet Kim Yo-jong, the youthful, bubbly younger sister of Kim Jong-un. I'm not quite sure that's the appropriate tone to take when reporting on the fairly ghastly family that runs North Korea, but nonetheless, this does tell us quite a lot of stuff we didn't know. How powerful do we think she is? She's 28 and clearly has her brother's ear, as it were, but yeah. Is she a big player?
Well, it would seem so, but once again, as with you know, the North Korean regime, you don't know much. So actually, this article has her as 28-year-old and another one has her at 30 years old. So this is how little we know about the person. But she does have her brothers here. She's been appearing in public more and more over the past 2 years. And she's actually been nominated in 2014 as the vice director of the Workers' Party's Propaganda and Agitation Department, where she was, you know, in a regime like North Korea, that's pretty high position to have. And she has been going up in ranks and apparently gaining influence. I mean, there's little you can know about the regime once again, but apparently gaining influence among Kim Jong-un's close circle.
I mean, it's always the key question, I think, with any story about North Korea is, do we get any sense of how the Straits Times knows the things they claim to know?
Yeah.
I mean, as you say, it's like the details such as they are, which are more than we've learned elsewhere, are still very sketchy.
They're very sketchy. I mean, the sources you have when it comes to North Korea is South Korean spy agency and Ministry of Foreign Affairs. It's usually newspapers that have sources themselves. It's usually defectors. And it's a few consultancies that probably rely on pretty much the same sources to tell you either the same or something different. It's very tough to get any information. I mean, once again, she is said by three different sources to be married, not married, have kids, not have kids. No one knows. Not anyone knows if Kim Jong-un has kids. So that's one of the questions being asked here, because will she be the next in line to power? There's a lot of doubt about that. But, you know, questions being raised about her just coming to power and into the light.
Okay, let's move along to Channel News Asia. This is it's one of those stories where I think that they've tried to come up with something big for the headline, and then once you actually read the story, it's the headline: Duterte's popularity dips after Philippines drug war protest. This is the Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte, and they sort of admit in the second paragraph that his approval rating is down to 67%.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, most democratic leaders
would dream of that.
Yes,
they'd
probably give you a couple of toes for 67%. But it is down from 78%. So there is a dip. Why?
There is a dip because, you know, I mean, Duterte has been waging a war on drugs, and it officially killed almost 4,000 people and unofficially a few thousand more in just executions, either by death squads or by the police. And so a few months ago, two teenagers were attacked by the police and killed. And it just provoked an outrage in the country, because one of them especially was a student, and the police said he was waving a gun at them, and it was legitimate defense. But footage was found of him in police custody. So apparently he didn't threatened the policemen. So there's been a huge outrage. There's been in September a lot of rallies and just marches to try and say, well, we're fed up with Duterte's war on drug. And actually, the one thing, probably the most interesting thing in a quite empty article, as you say, is the fact that the people where popularity has gotten down the most is among poor Filipinos, who are both usually the main voters for Duterte, but are also the main victims of his war on drugs. So I think that has an effect.
Okay, we'll move along finally to a remorselessly cheerful story from Xinhua Net. Tourism booming, it says, during China's National Day holiday. They sound weirdly surprised, but isn't that the kind of day on which tourism is going to boom?
So it's actually another day. It's 8 days, and it's what is one of the two golden weeks that China has. So there's two compulsory kind of holiday weeks that you have to take in China when you're working there. And the first one was last week, and I don't know if they're, I mean, they're surprised. It's growing very quickly, but I think the reason I picked this story is because of the sheer numbers. Because the headline says 700 million people traveled last week, which is almost as much as the US and Europe moving somewhere else for a week. And only in one of the provinces, Inner Mongolia, 106 million tourism went there and visited, which to me is just incredible.
It is, I mean, you're right, of course, that it is, whenever you read any story about, I think, just the day-to-day economic activity of China, it is the numbers that are mind-boggling. 110 million trips by railway since September 28th. 6 million Chinese from 300 cities travel to 1,155 cities in 88 countries, which is quite interesting in itself, because that's still not a thing that's a mainstream activity for Chinese yet, is it? Overseas travel. Well, when I say mainstream, it's 6 million people. That's
exactly
the entire population of some European countries, but nonetheless.
And it is in a sense that 122 million people actually traveled abroad last year from China, but it is much less than actually well, domestic tourism, which is what the government is betting on. They're investing a lot at the moment. They're trying to develop infrastructure. And it's a real big market for an economy that, as everyone knows, is unbalanced and needs consumer growth. And that's one of the ways.
Agatha Kratz, thanks as always for joining us. You're listening to The Daily. Finally tonight, tomorrow's edition of our Design Show Section D jets off to the Future Architecture Festival in Ljubljana for a special look at the built environment. The festival, held last week, was an opportunity for Europe's young architects to exchange ideas, and Monocle's Guy Delaunay dropped in to learn more.
There's a distinct buzz in the courtyard of Ljubljana's Museum of Architecture and Design, where delegates from across Europe are taking a break between sessions at the Future Architecture Festival.
It's actually more than a network, a platform. It's a system where we try to create environment for institutions, for practicing architects, for researchers, curators, to exchange.
Mateusz Czelek is the director of the Museum of Architecture and Design, which just so happens to be the coordinating entity behind the Future Architecture platform.
It's addressing the up-and-coming generation of architects and professionals, and we wanted to bring in the ideas, thinking about the future, because we are looking at the projects that are complete and we are trying to evaluate them. That's what happens mainly in the architectural media now. So we wanted to bring in the ideas and talking about the future and try to envision what should be done. In the platform, people are really thinking about how architecture can help society. They want to address the most pressing issues of our time. Issues of inequality, issues of migration, of pollution, climate change. That's a trend in other professions as well. We became more aware of what are the consequences of our actions, but it's good to see that happening in architecture as well.
Future Architecture has 18 institutional members from a total of 15 countries, but its reach is wider than that. It offers an opportunity for young architects from around the world, or indeed anyone with an interest in architecture, to answer the open call for project ideas. The successful applicants are then matched with one of the institutional members to carry out their projects. Fanny Kosturu personifies the cross-border nature of Future Architecture. She and her two colleagues are from Greece, based in London, and got the chance to work with the Belgrade International Architecture Week. Their project was perfectly suited to the war-damaged, economically ravaged Serbian capital. Activate modern ruins.
We've been working on ruins for a very long time. We have these kind of like derelict infrastructures, abandoned. I mean, with the crisis, it's all over the place, right?
How do you think you've grown as an architect, but perhaps also as a human being, over the past 9 months?
It has been a great change, mainly because you realize that what you're doing is very relevant to what other people are doing. It broadens your mind in the sense of like, oh, I haven't thought that, or what about that? And oh, he looks at ruins from a, like, you know, public engagement point of view, and he looks at ruins from, you know, romanticizing, and he looks at ruins from, you know, the potential of like future decay as well as past decay. You know, there are lots of kind of talks, and that makes you being really alert socially, but architecturally in your field.
Future architecture isn't just for the benefit of its more youthful participants. The hosting institutions say they gain as well. Danica Jovovic-Prodanovic is one of the organizers of Belgrade International Architecture Week.
It's always good to have international relationships and to build something that was, let's say, stopped in certain moments, end of 90s, etc., etc. But it's a big challenge for the city, and a lot of changes are happening right now around the city. And we as architects, we like to be part of it, but also to comment it, to have a let's say creative discussions on it, and to try to influence these changes that are happening.
Jesteśmy z Muzeum Architektury i realizujemy na Przedmieściu Ławskim warsztaty, które są częścią takiego większego ogólnoeuropejskiego przedsięwzięcia, które nazywa się Future Architecture Platform. Jest taką
Poland's fourth largest city and its people are looking to architects and urbanists to improve their quality of life. Michal Duda of Wrocław's Architecture Museum says membership of Future Architecture brings a much needed international perspective to local challenges. That's why he was delighted to work on a project to revive public spaces in a rundown neighborhood with Milanese landscape architect Barbara Boscaroli.
It's very fruitful for us to change the perspective and invite to very tiny local project people who will come with something completely fresh, completely different. Maybe not fresh in Milan, but still fresh where we are from. It's also a very nice thing about this new generation of architects that they're coming from the different countries, different cities, but they are not delivering their own ideas and try to implement somewhere abroad. They are very sensitive about the locality, very sensitive about the people from the place where they are acting. That kind of sensitivity is a part of our, I hope it is a part of our future.
Just a couple of introductory remarks. First, also my congratulations to you, the 25 candidates.
This year's festival may be over, but the projects continue, and the Future Architecture Platform has secured EU funding to continue for years to come. If its vision becomes reality, the next generation of architects should be better connected and more in tune with the needs of the people they ultimately serve. And surely, that's a future we can all get behind. For Monocle in Ljubljana, I'm Guy Delaunay.
This is ideology embodied.
Yep. Thank you, Architecture Platform, for having us here.
Great debate. Waiting for the next one.
You can tune into the full edition of Section D at 1900 London time tomorrow on Monocle 24. You can, of course, catch up with that and all our other programming anytime you like after that on our website. That is it for today's edition of The Daily. The show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli. The researchers were Daphne Karnesis and Alessio Dellana. Our studio manager was George McDonough. The Globalist is here 8 hours from now with Tyke Enright. The Daily returns at the same time tomorrow. I'm Andrew Mullop. Thanks for listening.